Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
A very good morning to you all and welcome to this edition of Africa Link. This Wednesday, the 26th October 2016. I'm Isaac Mugabe, your host in Bonn, Germany. Coming up, Al-Shabaab Islamists in Somalia kill at least 12 people in the Kenyan border town of Mandera. We hear from a survivor of the attack, a visitor to the town belonging to a theater group.
I'm an actress. I was shot at more than three times.
I am an actress. I was shot at more than three times. Then after the explosion, I was buried under the rubble. But by God's grace, the military soldiers were just outside the building.
South Africa's President Jacob Zuma has said he cannot stop the prosecution of his finance minister Pravin Gordhan because interfering would drive the country closer to a banana republic.
No intervention you can make once the law enforcement agencies act and take matters to court. Only the court can look and judge on that matter.
Also on the program, French crews begin demolishing makeshift shelters, removing tarpaulins and scrap materials that made up the so-called Django migrant camp near Calais. Stay tuned to these stories in the next 25 minutes.
Top story.
At least 12 people have been killed in an attack in Kenya claimed by Somalia-based militant Islamist group Al-Shabaab. The target was a guest house hosting members of a theater group who were performing plays in schools in the northeastern town of Mandera. Also on Tuesday, an Al-Shabaab suicide bomber attacked an African Union military base housing Djiboutian soldiers in the central Somali city of Beledweyne. It is not known how many were killed in that attack, which comes as Somalia is preparing for elections, which are due at the end of November. From Nairobi, Andrew Asike sent this report.
12 people were on Tuesday morning killed after Islamic extremist gunmen belonging to the Somalia-based Al-Shabaab militant group attacked and blew up Bisharo Hotel in Kenya's northern town of Mandera. Most of those who died from the attack were actors who had just visited Mandera County to perform a play based on a set book to students shortly before the start of examinations for the Kenya Certificate of Secondary Education. Victoria Wambui, a survivor of the attack, told reporters from her hospital bed how she was rescued by the Kenya Defense Forces soldiers while buried under the rubble after the explosion.
I'm an actress. I was shot at more than three times.
I am an actress. I was shot at more than three times. Then, after the explosion, I was buried under the rubble. But by God's grace, the military soldiers were just outside the building. I screamed. That is when they came and rescued me together with a friend of mine. Earlier, while I was hiding in the bathroom, they tried to fire bullets at us, but by the grace of God, they missed most of the time.
By God's grace, zilikuwa zina miss.
Another survivor, David Ogoji, had traveled to Mandera, where he was also to perform in a play. He says that he was bodily hurled out of the room by the militants after they had detonated the explosion.
I was hiding someplace in the lodge, and after the bombing, I was thrown outside. Stones fell on top of me, and that's how I survived. The militants used their torches to see if anyone was still conscious after the blast. I did not move. I was mute, and that's how I survived. 1 hour later, the Kenya Defense Forces came and rescued us.
And that's when we found our way to the hospital.
Seven governors from northeastern region condemned the attack that claimed the lives of 12 people in Mandera, calling on the government to step up its game and ensure that there was ample security in the region posed by Al-Shabaab militants. Ahmed Abdullahi is the governor of Wajir County.
These people are opportunistic. They hit when you least expect them to. But we constantly also must up our game, both in the prevention of attacks, but also in dealing with issues of youth radicalization.
Ali Roba, governor of Mandera County, appealed to the general public to help the authorities in fighting Al-Shabaab.
Somebody somewhere must be aware. Somebody somewhere must be aiding. Somebody somewhere must be in that planning who is a local, and we need to make sure that the population of this region take that responsibility to make sure that they give them the support required for the government to fight terrorism.
Mandera town has been targeted by Al-Shabaab gunmen in the past. One reason for this is its close proximity to the porous Kenya-Somali border, which gives the Somalia-based militants easy access to the area. Earlier this month, six people were killed when gunmen attacked a residential house in Mandera town. The leader of opposition Raila Odinga has called on the Kenyan government to devolve part of the police service down to county level to help end the recent spate of terror attacks.
Andrew Asike reporting from Nairobi. This was the second Al-Shabaab strike on Mandera in 3 weeks. The previous one on October 6th killed six people at a gated residential building that mainly housed non-Muslims. So are the Islamists becoming stronger, or are Kenya's and Somalia's security agencies becoming less vigilant? A question I put to Angina Ojwang, a political analyst based in Nairobi.
It is difficult to say, but one can say that the Al-Shabaab is upgrading its operational skills, widening the area of operation. So they sometimes strike in areas where they are least expected to be able to strike. However, it is also true that there seems to be some laxity on the part of the security agencies, more so the Kenyan security agencies in northeastern part of Kenya and the coastal provinces, because you don't have a similar level of attacks in the other parts of Kenya, Nairobi, Nakuru, and so on. So there is need for them, those security personnel at the border areas, to be more vigilant. It seems they are not yet able to predict and prevent Al-Shabaab attacks as they should be doing.
Governors from Kenya's northern frontier with Somalia called on Kenya's leadership to speed up the building of the border wall. Do you think the wall will solve Kenya's security problem?
I do not think so. The leadership of Al-Shabaab are well-traveled persons on their way out for training in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and other areas of the world. So they are people who know the terrain very well in Eastern Africa. Secondly, the border area communities operate on both sides of the border in a very fluid manner, and creating the border would be a major hardship to the communities that reside in those areas. So it will not be welcomed by the communities. Thirdly, is that since Al-Shabaab is already recruiting from the information emanating from our own sources, Kenyan intelligence sources, in places like Nakuru and Naivasha and so on, it means they are moving deep and deep into Kenya. They are becoming multi-ethnic. So just walling the Somalis out will not be a way of preventing the Al-Shabaab, because Al-Shabaab will be ethnicless, in that any ethnic can become Al-Shabaab and can become an operative. So that may not be the best way to wall them out.
Al-Shabaab claims it is targeting Kenya because of their military intervention in Somalia, which began in October 2011. But do you think that these attacks would really cease if the Kenyans were to pull out of Somalia?
Right now, the chances of them ceasing is almost nil, because Al-Shabaab has recruited more Kenyans, has expanded its operations, and has scaled up the number of its complaints against the Kenyan government. So I think we are already having an Al-Shabaab Kenyan command with cells in Kenya and all that. So the issue is not yet just Kenyan soldiers being in Somaliland. It is now basically just like any terrorist organization, Al-Qaeda or the Taliban or any other. So they want to seize state power in Kenya, and that's what they are aiming at now.
Which brings me to my question. How much of a problem is radicalization in Kenya, inside Kenya?
The recruitment of Al-Shabaab is successful, and it is successful because the state, in its economic program, is allowing a lot of youth to drop through the safety net, so they find themselves in a hopeless situation, and Al-Shabaab comes with a plausible alternative way of living. You become a member, you become a leader, you are educated, you become a commander. So instead of being an employed youth in Nairobi or Mombasa or Kisumu, you are a commander somewhere in Somalia or in northeastern Kenya or somewhere in the world. So that is very attractive to young people. So as long as we do not create a situation whereby the youth will be absorbed and unemployment diminished, and also we do not carry out policies that make other people feel they are not part of the society, we shall be creating adequate or ideal climate for Al-Shabaab to recruit members into its organization.
Angina Ojwang, a political analyst based in Nairobi.
News, analysis, and feature reports. All that here on Africa Link.
South African President Jacob Zuma has said he supported Finance Minister Pravin Gordhan, who's due in court next week on criminal charges widely seen as politically motivated. Gordhan, a respected veteran of the ruling ANC party, will appear in court on November 2nd on charges relating to a colleague's early retirement back in 2010. Analysts say Gordhan has been targeted by Zuma loyalists in the increasingly fractured ANC. Zuma said he had not acted to stop the prosecution of Gordhan because interfering would drive the country closer to a banana republic. From Johannesburg, Tuzo Kumalo sent this report.
With South Africa's economic future hanging in the balance ahead of the Finance Minister Gordhan's appearance in court on what many have described as trumped-up charges, members of South Africa's Upper House of Parliament, the National Council of Provinces, or NCOP, wanted Zuma to provide some answers. Gordhan will appear in court on the 2nd of November on fraud charges, but legal experts say this is an attempt by Zuma to remove him from office because he refused to tolerate corrupt practices. The Opposition Democratic Alliance, DA, asked if Zuma was planning to intervene in Gordhan's matter to save the economy.
No intervention you can make once the law enforcement agencies act and take matters to court. Only the court can look and judge on that matter.
The DA also wanted to know if he will withdraw his court challenge against the release of the public protector's report, likely to show that the rich Gupta family was appointing cabinet ministers on his behalf. Again, he said no.
As a citizen of this country, I have a legal right to exercise my rights. I interdicted it. There's nothing wrong. It has nothing to do with ratings.
His refusal has now paved the way for the matter to be heard in court next month. Zuma's visit to the National Council of Provinces, NCOP, on Tuesday to answer questions angered members of the Economic Freedom Fighters Party, EFF, who refused to be addressed by him. EFF member Yunus Vauda said they were not prepared to sit and listen to Zuma speak.
The Honorable Jacob Zuma is not competent enough to be president of this country.
And another EFF member, Nkakiseng Koni, embarrassed the president by making this remark.
This order. Man, this sitting there, order. Is order. A murderer.
Order.
Look, he's laughing. This sitting there,
order.
Is a thief.
Honorable,
this
honorable
man sitting there.
NCOP Speaker Thandi Modise had her hands full. She ejected all EFF members out of the house one by one.
Order! Order!
And we will leave this house order. On those grounds.
Order! Parliamentary Protection Services, please assist the member.
Analysts have warned that bringing charges against the finance minister and the Gupta affair involving Zuma could plunge the country's already shaky economy into even deeper problems. A number of senior ruling African National Congress members have broken ranks with Zuma on these two issues, and the consequences could be dire for the government or the ruling party or both.
Tuzo Kumalo reporting from Johannesburg.
Behind the headlines.
French workers began demolishing makeshift shelters, removing tarpaulins and scrap materials that made up the so-called Django migrant camp near Calais as former residents, migrants seeking entry to Britain, were moved out. The sound of sledgehammers tearing away at the makeshift camp in Calais. Meanwhile, last week, a group of refugee children from the jungle arrived in the United Kingdom. Under pressure from charities and church groups, the British government agreed to take in at least 300 of the unaccompanied kids. To be eligible, the children had to prove that they have family members already settled in Britain. Like almost all the migrants in the camp, which is now being demolished, the children had been intent on reaching the UK, and to do so, they travelled from as far as Syria, Afghanistan, Pakistan and Kuwait. But as Stephen Beard reports from London, the group got a rather mixed reception in Britain.
A small ripple of applause from well-wishers as the first group of young migrants walked into a government office in South London. Not exactly the warmest of welcomes. Indeed, some of the press coverage here was openly hostile. The problem was the apparent age of the migrants. Some of them didn't look like children at all. Some appeared to be in their mid to late 20s. A Conservative Member of Parliament, David Davies, called for dental checks on the arrivals to establish they were not adults masquerading as vulnerable kids.
We were given the impression that there were very young children who were desperate to get into the UK, and that doesn't seem to have happened. What we seem to have here is young men who may be under 18 or maybe over 18. It's very hard to say, and that's why I've suggested that perhaps we should use age checks, dental checks, to just verify that, because we don't want to, at the end of the day, we do need to make sure the public have confidence in the system.
That confidence was further dented by official figures published in the UK this week. They showed that more than two-thirds of around 1,000 young people claiming to be children on entering the UK as refugees over the past year were, in fact, adult. This lady, Janet, who's looked after a number of unaccompanied young refugees, recounted her experience with a young Afghan who was claiming to be 14.
He turned up at our house with severe stubble and needed a razor straight away. And I had to take him to the dentist. And the dentist queried his age. He said, "How old did you say he was?" And I said, 14. And he just shook his head and he said, "He's 21, 22 at least."
Say it loud, say it clear!
Refugees are welcome here!
The young migrants do have their supporters. Charities and church groups have campaigned passionately on their behalf. There clearly are many children who are desperate to reach Britain, and some do have family members already settled here. George Gabriel of the campaign group Citizens UK argued that it would be hardly surprising if many of the children did look older than they are.
Many of these children, you know, if we're really honest, the reason why they look so old is because they've been waiting in the Calais jungle for a whole year trying to reach their loved ones, risking their lives every single night on the trains and on 14 lines of razor wire.
The British government has agreed to take in from Calais 300 young people with family connections in Britain. It's also accepted that under the so-called Dubs Amendment, it will take in unaccompanied children without family in the UK, as many of them as can be accommodated by local authorities. So far, those local authorities have offered homes to 3,000. But in Parliament, there's still some adamant opposition to this. Here's Conservative lawmaker Phil Davies.
Why do genuine refugees need to come from France into the UK to be properly looked after? Why can't France process people's asylum applications? What's so terrible about refugees living in France? Why do they have to come to the UK?
The answer, says actress and activist Juliet Stevenson, is obvious. The young migrants in Calais have not been well treated in France.
Well, I think the truth is that the French government have displayed no commitment to the welfare of these children at all throughout the existence of this camp. In fact, the levels of police brutality in Calais have been incredibly shocking.
A report by Stephen Beard. Authorities in Cameroon have urged locals to donate blood to save the lives of survivors of last weekend's train crash that left at least 80 people dead and hundreds wounded. Giving blood in Cameroon is uncommon, and the drive to mobilize blood donors has not been smooth, as might have been expected during an emergency like this. Among prominent public figures to step forward and encourage blood donations is South Africa's High Commissioner to Cameroon, Zanele Makina. Having just donated blood himself, he called on others to do likewise. From Yaounde, Mokinzeka filed this report.
In Beamase, a neighborhood in Yaounde, family members and friends give thanks that the life of 27-year-old Nicole Ekane was spared. The lucky survivor says rescue workers transported her to a mortuary at Eseka, where the train crash occurred, before realizing that she was still alive.
I was climbing on dead people for the first time in my life. I had to witness such that number of dead people.
Nicole was traveling with her neighbor and friend, Ekwele Magdalene, to Douala on a business trip. Magdalene is also grateful that she too survived.
I thought it was all over when I found myself on the ground with many people lying on top of me.
Nicole and Ekwele were lucky. The Land family at Swa on the outskirts of Yaoundé were less fortunate. Rigobert Land says he lost his younger brother because medical staff did not come to his rescue.
He died on a train. That's the last information I received about my younger brother. While he was lying wounded in the train, he told me that he could still breathe, but there was no medical assistance, no first aid. At 5 p.m., I was informed that my brother's body had been removed from the wreckage. That's how I heard about my younger brother's death.
At least 80 people died and 600 were injured when the train, carrying more than 1,300 passengers, derailed and flipped over at Eseka station last Friday. The train was carrying twice as many passengers as normal because of disruptions to road travel between Yaoundé and Douala. Cameroon is asking its citizens to donate blood in order to help save the lives of crash victims. Among the donors is Zanelli Makina, South Africa's High Commissioner to Cameroon.
I also picked up that one of the reasons that the blood is so scarce, it is because people are very superstitious about donating blood. I've also enlisted some friends to donate blood, but importantly is that I appeal to the youth, young people mainly, to know that you are saving a life. What more can you give for your nation? You don't know, maybe one day it may be your relative who's lying there and who will die because of the shortage of blood.
Cameroonians say they do not understand why social media circulated information that there had been a train crash hours before it actually happened. Road travel was disrupted when culvert pipe-like constructions underneath the road gave way just that very day without warning. And why, Cameroonians ask, did the railway company permit such an overcrowded train to run in the first place? President Paul Biya has ordered an investigation into the crash, but Cameroon has never been known to publish the outcome of inquiries into such tragedies in the past.
Moke Kinzeka reporting.
Opinion.
For our opinion segment this week, we'd like to hear your thoughts on whether you think the demolition of the Django camp in Calais will deter African migrants from trying to get to the United Kingdom via France. We would also like to hear what you think about safety on trains in Africa that are always filled beyond their capacity. We've just been hearing about the weekend crash in Cameroon. Send your thoughts to feedback.africa@dw.com, a letter to Africa link DW531100 Bonn, Germany, or an SMS to country code 49160957-59510.
Africa Link, your gateway to the stories that are moving Africa. From October 31st, live at 16 UTC or as audio on demand from DW in Germany.
And now a reminder of some of the stories that we've covered for you in the last 25 minutes. Al-Shabaab Islamists in Somalia have killed at least 12 people, including members of a theater group in the Kenyan border town of Mandera. Authorities in Cameroon have urged locals to donate blood to help save the lives of hundreds injured in a train crash over the weekend. French workers have begun demolishing makeshift shelters, removing tarpaulins and scrap materials that made up the so-called Django migrant camp near Calais, as former residents, migrants seeking entry to Britain, were moved to locations elsewhere in France. This is Isaac Mugabe in Bonn.